the most recent manifestation of what I call the general criteria, now called, well, it's not the most recent, there's probably been one since here.
Yeah.
But effectively, this is setting out rules that any syllabus has got to conform to, and indeed, which awarding bodies have to conform to. So it will have things like the nature of the title of the syllabus and how clear it is. This is very much about the awarding body as such,
yeah.
But and it also lays down rules for how you award the grade and such. So you have that set of criteria, and then you have the subject specific criteria. And what we used to do was go through these.
Yeah.
You can find these on the off-course site, the most recent version. But that's part of the problem. I mean, they get revised almost annually. But we go through the checklist, and we'd identify where they didn't match the checklist.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, boards have the checklist as well, so they've gone through the checklist.
Yeah.
Theoretically, it should have been a straightforward job. It was very hard with Mode 3 GCSEs, which there were in the early days, a number of Mode 3 GCSEs, where people had just tried to put a GCSE title on a CSE, a Mode 3 CSE, and we rejected a lot of those. And in many cases, the examining board used it as a great opportunity to say, well, you know, this has been a lost leader for us. I mean, the
did those disappear pretty quickly, those Mode 3 GCSEs?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, one of the big differences that happened with GCSE was the creation of the six GCSE boards. The really strong thing about the CSE was that it was regional. I mean, if you were doing a CSE in London, you did it with the London Regional Examining Board. And so it was a kind of very close relationship between an examining board and the teachers who did the syllabus. So things like monitoring and moderation and such like were quite tightly done because it was a local, regional thing. And that kind of regional link was broken with GCSE because you could take your GCSE from any one of the six areas. O level had always been like that, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, but CSE, it was different. And I've spent a lot of time over the years looking at how to improve the whole business of the moderation of coursework and improving teacher assessment and such like. Most recently, I've been doing work with the Institute of Chartered Assessors on the use of chartered assessors almost as mentors to schools to improve the assessment. Because you'll know that all the inspection results say that the weakness in schools is assessment. But the other issue is, as well as chartered assessors, you can look at a much more regional focus so that you bring teachers around the region. And a lot of English teachers, for example, would say that the strongest thing about moderation was the fact that you came together with other English teachers and an opportunity to talk about work and that sort of, that local moderation, which in many ways got lost, so the whole thing got bigger.
Yeah.
And it became much more postal moderation. I mean, we did all postal moderation on GCSE.
Yes. I wanted to ask you about the link with A-level, because you referred to, you developed the GCSE and A-level history criteria. How much was A-level changing as a result of what had happened at GCSE, if you look at the late 80s, early 90s?
Well, when I went into SEC and SEAC, there were no A-level criteria as such.
No, that's what I would have thought.
And during the 1990s, you got the development of A-level criteria. It was a slow process, but if you took the view, as people like Eric Evans did and quite a number of us did, that an examination system had to be transparent. And therefore you had to be clear about what it was you were assessing and what it was you were rewarding. And you had to have some way of being able to express this not only to teachers but to parents and to employers.
That whole concept of having a transparent examination system, do you think that came out of the 1988 Act, or do you think it was something that was a bottom-up demand, or, you know, sort of consumerist approach to things? Where did it come from?
I don't think it came out of the 1988 Act. I think it was there before that. I think you can see it in the 80s move towards GCSE. I think the whole point, you'd have to go back and look at what it was that Sir Keith Joseph was trying to do by moving towards a common examination system.
Well, actually, looking at his speech, which I've got a copy of, there's not really a mention of transparency as being one of the objectives. And I did wonder whether it was part and parcel of the move to make schools accountable, which is part of the 1988 Act, isn't it? But if you say it started before that, what provoked a change? Because before that, in the 70s, 60s, 50s, exam boards were extremely secretive.
And yes, laws unto themselves.
Absolutely, never explained themselves. You never saw a paper, did you? You never got a paper back after it had been marked. You never got full explanation of mark variations, or as you said, what the criteria
were. The appeal system was very limited.
Yeah. Is that the same as CSE? Was it connected to this local moderation of CSE, perhaps, that people had to be more explicit?
Again, it all depends on your level of understanding, where you were in the system. You know, given that in the 70s and 80s I was a teacher within the system and I'd only just started examining. Yeah. I think it may have a lot to do with the links, the greater transparency of CSE, but also a feeling, which you're right, in one sense, I suppose, the national curriculum also brought about, was that, you know, that children's education was too important to leave simply to teachers. Mm. One point I think that I've always been a supporter of a national curriculum on has been the idea that the national curriculum is approved by Parliament and as such is in the public domain, and what is taught is in the public domain and anybody can have access to what is being taught. Mm. One of the things we did in 1999, for example, when we brought in the 2000 curriculum, was we actually produced a guide for parents, which we thought was important. And in fact, my argument in the mid-21st century was that actually we should stop producing a national curriculum for teachers and we should produce a national curriculum as a booklet for parents and employers, and teachers should then take from it what they needed to teach it in schools. That, you know, we really got our audience wrong for a national curriculum.
Yes.
And that, you know, you can look at the national curriculum in some countries like Sweden, for example, or Norway is the classic example, where the national curriculum is a vibrant document designed for the nation, but it isn't something you teach from. But a lot of people will cite the Norwegian national curriculum as a wonderful document that's full of poetry and...
Oh, it's sort of ideals rather than content. Yes.
It is. And our national curriculum, in many ways, has always fallen between two stools of being ideals. And what's interesting when you come to look at the history of national curriculum is that a lot of the philosophy and thinking about the national curriculum in history is in the final working group report.
Yeah.
And of course, that never translated over to what schools received. So the kind of understand. So you have this biggest the problem that, as I say, I've come to wrestle with time and time again since I've become more involved in developing curricula, is this mismatch between intentions of the people who have got very high intentions about why they develop this curriculum, what they want, what they believe it's going to do.
Mm.
And the perceptions at the other end of the scale of the people who actually receive it. And you probably know that there's some research done in Northern Ireland into the curriculum, not just the history curriculum, this is general. And it was a longitudinal study carried out by NFER for the Northern Ireland Curriculum Council. And it looked at pupils' perception of the curriculum.
I haven't come across that study, actually. Do you know what years it was?
I can find it for you.
That'd be really useful.
But it's not something I've dug out for this. But effectively...
Yeah, it's not specifically history, is it? Yeah, it's a broader thing.
It identifies five levels, I think. I'll forget the fourth, but never mind. There was the kind of... the written curriculum, the given curriculum, that is as intended. Then there's the... what's the next level? next level is the received curriculum.
Oh, I have come across that. Yes, yes, I have.
And then ultimately you get the curriculum as it's actually delivered, which is so far removed from what was intended by the time it's been through all these filters.
I would like to look at that, yes, because I can't remember where I've come across it, because I do remember the five levels.
I use it a lot when I'm talking to... I was in Geneva in December talking to a group from Pakistan about, you know, they were talking about curriculum implementation. Mm. And I was talking about, well, you know, it's one thing to say what you want, it's quite another to make what you want happen in a classroom.
That has been such an important theme in what we've been doing in the research project, you know, talking to people, politicians, who are so far removed from it, about how they want their ideas to be translated.
I thought you were thinking about Ken Clark not knowing whether what he wanted ever happened.
Oh, that's good, yeah, I know.
But still...
So that's interesting about A-level coming along behind.
But anyway, we developed criteria on the basis that if you got GCSE criteria, then it made sense to have A-level criteria. And the A-level criteria very much, I can remember doing a first draft, and we used the GCSE criteria as a model and shifted on. But we negotiated that through the... We had a GCSE committee and an A-level committee, so we negotiated that through the A-level committee, and those GCSE A-level criteria came in, and as far as I know, well, they still must exist, because those criteria I showed you are supported by subject criteria, which again must be on the website. But
That's lovely. Thank you very much. So then you were...
So then I went to SEC.
SEAC, and then...
SEAC, and then SCAR.
You were also on... No, you weren't on NCC.
No.
No.
But I was on the... Nick Tate and I used to share platforms in the early days. He was NCC, I was SEAC. I would always argue that curriculum must precede assessment, therefore Nick always spoke first. Which was always fun, because it always meant I could work out what I was going to say on the basis of what he'd said. He was on my committee, and I was on his committee. So when he set up the National Curriculum History Advisory Group to take the final report and to look at how they would revise it in the light of the consultation responses, then I was on that group, as was Kate Morse, and as was... Josh Brewman and Andy Reid, and you were saying you've got Andy's notes from that.
I have, yes, I have. And also, Robert Guyver said he was going to send me a load of letters, and he hasn't done so. I just remembered that, because he got some of the letters from the consultation. Yeah. That's the first consultation, but the consultation on the final report, you were working on that, weren't you, after that? So I don't know whether there's anything that Andy's got in his files on...
That's the national history. That's the first history curriculum.
Yeah.
Interim regroup.
Yeah, got all that.
Yeah.
And that.
That one.
Yeah.
That's the letter from McGregor.
Yes.
To SEAC saying, before I put this out for consultation, I want to know whether the assessment works.
Yeah.
And that led to me having to set up a group to develop this advice, which was the feasibility of history working group's proposals for the purposes of assessment.
Of course, the assessment had been based around those wretched attainment targets, hadn't it?
Not really. No, yeah. The assessment had to be based around the attainment targets.
Yeah, so in a sense, that's what you were trying to work out, whether they'd... you would be able, from your assessment, to judge whether students had reached the attainment target.
What you'd have to appreciate was that the History and Geography Working Group sat at the same time. The Geography Working Group, under pressure from civil servants, had created attainment targets and levels based on knowledge. Mm. So Paris was level 1, Berlin was level 2. Mm. The History Working Group refused to go down a route that said, you know... Caesar's invasion is level 1 and Battle of Trafalgar is level 7.
Mm.
And so had, you know, using what was then fairly much in its infancy, if you think about the kind of examining we'd be doing on level response, about how you can put cause and consequence into levels. I mean, most of the level response mark scheme, even even Dennis's would, you know, at most would run to 6 levels. The idea of trying to drag something out over 10 levels was bizarre. But, you know, so it, like anything in assessment, it was a hypothesis.
But GCSE already had implicitly the levels in it, didn't they? They had 9 levels, I think, did they?
They had grades.
Yes.
But they're not levels. I mean, they describe performance.
Yeah.
But there's only 3 descriptions of performance. A, C and...
G.
G, yeah. I think. And you identify the other grades arithmetically between those points. So you have, if you like, grade descriptions for 3 grades, and then the other grades are fixed arithmetically.
Mm.
And of course you mark by numbers anyway.
Mm.
You don't. But at this point, you know, TGAP was new. The idea was that everything would be 1 to 10. And ironically, since CSE level 1 was the highest grade you could get, on TGAT, 1 was the lowest grade you could get.
Oh, yes.
So it was all back to front.
Yes.
And there was a period where the proposal was that GCSE, to match the national curriculum, would move from A to G to 1 to 10.
The other way around, yes. So 10 would be A.
And the first 2 years of national curriculum, before the history orders in fact, there were lots of debates about how GCSE would conform, because GCSE had only just been invented, it had only just started.
Mm.
You know, Kenneth Baker still argues that he would have wanted to have stopped the national curriculum at 14. He's now very much into 14 to 19 as a concept.
Yes, he said he would have liked it to go through to 16, yes.
Yeah. But,
and in fact, even Ken Clark was close to saying, more or less said that now, that he would favour it.
What, history going through to 16?
Yes.
And it was Ken Clark who stopped it going through to 16. So that was the working group book. That's the final proposals. In which does the letter?
Mm.
And I noticed quite amusingly, because at SEAC we had, that was our coding for letters.
Yes.
So that's me.
Yeah.
So that's my only claim to fame. So that was the final working group report. And then that was the consultation report. That was the one that Nick's group produced. And I remember doing a response to the department, I think in response to a request from you about what happened to the consultation responses.
Mm.
And my understanding was that they were lodged in the House of Lords, but I'm not sure.
It was Elaine Scholar who was trying to find them. They're not, as far as I can find out.
I mean, the only person who would know, I guess, would be Nick Tate.
Yeah, in Geneva.
He's just finished that job. He's just retired. But I've got his email address if you want to get in touch with him.
Yes.
I mean, he's a pretty important person in national curriculum history.
Well, if Robert Guyver has got all these copies of these letters, then I get them from him.
Yeah.
Actually, I've just remembered he said he'd send them when he was ready, sort of thing. So I could follow it up. Yes, if you've got Nick Tate's email, that'd be great.
I'm going to start a list of things I'm going to send you. One was that report in Northern Ireland.
Yes.
Actually, Nick Tate's email address is his Geneva address. So
I probably got it then. I went on the website and had a look. But anyway, if you've got it, that would be
helpful. Sue Bennett would know about where Nick is. I don't know whether you've met Sue Bennett.
I have at that event, the same thing, the seminar. Yeah.
Yeah. Sue was the person who was appointed by Nick, worked with Nick, and then took over from Nick in terms of... NCC.
NCC, yeah.
And then she became, when SEAC and NCC merged to become SCAR, she and I became the history officers, and we ended up doing the Deering Review.
Can we move? Are you all right? You're not weary with talking?
No. I think, like you, I need to go to the loo for a bit.
Right. Stop.